Hello, welcome back to the second series of the Smart Life podcast. We're absolutely delighted to be back, and gosh, hasn't the world changed just a little bit since we last released an episode back in 2019? Now we've got a fantastic second series lined up for you with some brilliant guests from across the IoT and smart home industries, discussing everything from agriculture to education to electric vehicles and energy usage in the new normal of a post-COVID-19 world. So without further ado, welcome to Series 2, Episode 1 of the Smart Life Podcast. Hello, and welcome to episode one of the second series of the Smart Life podcast, exploring the latest in smart home technology and IoT. This podcast is created in conjunction with the Smart Homes and Buildings Association and produced by Beacon Agency. I'm Thomas Joy, and in today's episode, we're going to be asking one of the most crucial questions facing not just various technology industries, but actually all of society. How can we use technology to get to carbon zero? Now, to discuss this with me, I'm joined by a formidable panel, including Stephen Pattenden, Secretary of the UK's Smart Homes and Buildings Association, which is an industry-wide organisation with a speciality in the IoT industry, with specialist panels in health and wellbeing, energy and transport, as well as a central getting-to-market panel for retailers and manufacturers. Also joining me today is Remy Volpe, VP and General Manager of Residential Temperature Controls at Schneider Electric. Now, Schneider Electric provide energy and automation digital solutions for efficiency and sustainability by combining world-leading energy technologies, real-time automation, software and services into integrated solutions for homes, buildings, data centres, infrastructure and industries. And their mission is to empower everyone to make the most of their energy and resources by providing automation and digital solutions for efficiency and sustainability. And finally, we're thrilled to be welcomed back by returning guest, John Bradford, who's National Sales Manager at Delta Door. Now, Delta Door are pioneering leaders in the smart home and building solutions based over in Europe. And in a digital world that raises hope and concern in equal measures, they develop reliable, open and secure technological solutions to support energy transition and greater personal comfort, both at home and at work. So, Stephen, Remy, John, thank you so much for joining me today and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Good to be with you. Good to be here.
Fantastic. So the question of carbon zero is such an enormous question that I think we're all very consciously facing at the moment. Going forwards, what do you think are going to be the key innovations in the home and in the everyday consumer's life to help get society towards carbon zero?
If I guess maybe reflect on it generally just to start with, I think that it's important when we reflect on innovation that the innovations must take, let's say, solutions from connected objects as we see them today, more towards intelligent objects. And for me, that's quite a meaningful transition. You know, everyone's got these type of, your plug sockets to turn your kettle on or your smart heating system that brings, a lot of value to having elements of remote control and learning. For me, there needs to possibly be a step towards a greater intelligence, not just in the objects themselves, but the way in which they're, let's say, connected to meet the challenges that we face for zero carbon.
That's a very interesting point. And I think it was actually mentioned at CES earlier this year in the CES 2020 that they were saying that the 2010s were very much the year of the Internet of Things and getting things connected, but the 2020s are going to be the decade of the intelligence of things, making sure, everyone expects almost connectivity as standard. It's now what intelligence are these devices now using to make a difference?
Yeah, I think certainly so. And the other area that comes to mind is that, lots of companies are out there providing these different solutions. And I think one of the biggest problems around that transition, not only is understanding customer habits, let's say, or educating customers in how you can be more energy efficient, but also we as manufacturers, Schneider in the room as well, etc., we all, you know, maybe need to be a bit more efficient in actually how we talk to each other and talk to other manufacturers' products as well, because, you know, Delta Door is not going to be the one and only standalone solution. We all bring value. It's how can we maybe join that up a little bit more efficiently.
So Remy, just on that, I'm very conscious that Schneider Electric have sustainability kind of at the core of their mm-hmm. mission and ethos. You know, what are your thoughts on what John said there about sort of working together and sort of building in sustainability as a key part of your business?
Yeah, I think that's very important, and would concur with what John said. In essence, as we look forward, and if we wanted to, and we want to achieve a net zero or a carbon zero future, then no one party has the ability to do that. You know, I think collaboration is going to be key in helping us sort of get that particular outcome achieved. And I think as I look at it and the discussions I have with my sort of colleagues, we sort of feel that journey's sort of got three main pillars to it. You know, one is that collaboration. We have to have organizations working together. You know, I think we've got to have devices in the home interoperating or working together in a very easy way. And we have to be able to cover the whole home and not just, let's say, one vertical, not just the heating, not just the lighting, not just, you know, the devices. So I think collaboration's key. I think the second point is really around simplicity, and we've got to ensure that whatever innovation we're bringing to market, we really make it very easy to install, we make it very easy to sort of operate and interact with. Mm-hmm. So the design of the products, you know, the user interface is key, and the sort of installation, commissioning, and day-to-day use you know, has to be paramount. And the third part we look at is data. You know, I think that the aspect of starting any journey is you've got to know where you are today. And I think the sort of all the devices that are smart, maybe at the moment that are more operating around a single vertical, mm-hmm. the more data we can get out into a common area and that we can start to sort of show consumers what they're using, how they're using it, when they're using it, then, you know, that's any starting point on the journey. We know we're here, we now know where we want to go, and we can sort of use data as the yardstick to help us along that journey.
And I think that you know, as one of those pillars that you mentioned, being interoperability, I think is hugely crucial to not just in terms of getting to carbon zero also, but also in terms of the impact that the smart home market or the smart home industry can have on the market. You know, one of the greatest complaints that consumers have is that there are too many sort of disparate apps and devices and hubs, and they're not sure, you know, essentially which ones work together, or, you know, how long some of them are going to stick around, and whether or not, you know, they're sort of future-proofed. Stephen, just to bring you in here, and I hope you don't mind my saying that you've been in the smart home and the IoT market for quite a few years, now. In terms of that interoperability, obviously you're a big champion of the cause here of manufacturers, retailers, the whole industry talking together. How important do you think that sort of closer working ties are going to be as we all work towards carbon zero?
I think as interoperability, it's absolutely essential that everything sooner or later is going to have to work with everything else. And there needs to be an IoT or an interoperability system that actually enables one to look at that data that comes out of the devices and do something with it that's sensible. So yes, I think that's absolutely right. And I think both of what Remy and John have said is absolutely on the button. The problem that the question you've asked, how do we get to carbon zero? The first question is, when do you want to get there? And secondly, what does carbon zero mean? The problem basically is that the smart heating systems, the automatic plugs, the stuff that you've got in the house, it will save you quite a lot. There's no doubt about that. But it sooner or later it runs up against the fact that the heat you put into the house escapes through the windows, doors, walls and so on, and is effectively wasted. To get down to carbon zero, you want effectively net energy as well, net neutral energy as well. And that's an awful lot further than systems in the house will do. So I think the major question here is, yes, all the stuff we're doing, they need to be interoperable, they need to be something that makes the house much more comfortable. But when it comes down to it, how do we actually stop that energy creeping out into the environment and causing us to have more and more renewable sources of energy in the countryside and so on?
And do you think there's a role to play in terms of smart devices that, you know, people can use in their homes? Do you think that, you know, for example, using intelligent sensors to detect heat loss, or detecting, even going further and maybe in suggesting, you know, leak detection and things like that, do you think that, again, a big part of the issue is people necessarily don't know quite how much energy they are losing and where they're losing it? They don't know the problem that they're starting with, or do you think it's just a question of capital expense of insulating homes and windows and doors properly? It's
the capital expense. They can easily work out how much energy they're wasting, because it's almost all the energy they buy. I can remember a house in Milton Keynes in about 1990-ish, which actually was kept warm by its occupants and the light bulbs. We can do it. We've been able to do it for a long time. The energy strong people can do it. The passive house people can do it. We can get down to a level where the house is actually energy positive and it's carbon neutral or carbon zero, and that includes the stuff you put into the house to make it carbon neutral.
I completely agree with what you're saying, Stephen, as well. And the thing that it'd be interesting to get your thoughts on is, from where I sit, we have a massive problem in this country that we have 24 odd million individual homes with, let's say, old, out of date fabric, but we're only able to build 150,000 odd new homes per year at the moment. For me, that's a real problem, because what you talk about with the technology of passive house, etc., is it is there, you know, and it can be put into these new homes and these new builds, but. The big question that we also try and look at as well is, what do we do with the existing housing stock that's, you know, it's not going to go anywhere?
I'm afraid that the real answer is the energy strong approach, which is the T-coziest approach. You put insulation round the and you knock the cost out of it, and you knock the cost out of it through industrialization. If we're going to get to net zero energy by 2050, which is what we're targeted to be doing, that effectively means a million refurbishments per annum. It's a horrific number. If you can get the price of those refurbishments down to 50k a house, that is a lot of money. Now, you can look at it another way and say, if you can do that, it's a fantastic impact on the GDP of a country. And it applies to the whole of Europe to some extent. If you've got, say, 70 person days per house you refurbish, that's something in the region of 300,000 person years of direct employment. That'd be awfully useful at the moment.
Absolutely, absolutely. Remy, just in terms of, I'm conscious that Schneider Electric sort of work outside just the domestic the setting, and also sort of into everything from, you know, data centers, which are of course huge consumers of energy and bits like that. You know, what responsibility is there for actually the you know, IoT devices or any part of this industry to go beyond just the home, or just, you know, the odd, you know, smart switch or bits like that, and actually make real impact on the enormous commercial consumers of energy?
We absolutely have to do that, and we use a philosophy called grid to plug. You know, and I think it was Stephen who touched on it. You know, a lot of maybe, you know, or a part of what we do is around the components and the elements in a home, but you need to also look outside of the home as well if we ever are going to reach a carbon zero world. You know, you're right, Schneider plays pretty much, you know, a part in all of that, in the actual sort of efficient production of electricity. So, you know, so that sustainability, that sort of move towards clean energy, for Schneider is right the way across, starting from the grid all the way through to the plug. And I think it's one element to talk about, let's say the you know, the technology and the innovation that we have across that. You know, I think we also need to step up to the plate and say, well, as an organization and a manufacturer and a consumer of electricity, we also want to be, you know, carbon zero as well. So when we're looking at the products we manufacture, how we manufacture them, the facilities that we run and the offices that we have, you know, we've made a commitment to be carbon neutral by 2030 in our factories, in our offices. So there's a lot of challenges there. And I think, you know, boiling it down to my particular business, and it's a philosophy that's very easy to sort of, you know, have as a strap line or to put on a PowerPoint slide. But, you know, what it means is, you know, I have a factory over here in the UK. We manufacture in Plymouth. You know, and our facility there, you know, we're employing over 200 people. We already have a plan mapped out that says we'll be carbon neutral by 2025. And that starts to touch in terms of things like company cars. So, you know, if we want to be carbon zero, then we've got to make sure that the cars that we purchase and that we use as part of our business are all electric. And that needs to start now. So we're already up and running with that. We already have a plan that any new vehicles that are ordered are going to be electric vehicles. We also, being in Plymouth, are very conscious in terms of waste that goes out into the sea as well, and the use of plastics and other elements. So we already have drastically reduced that. We're looking at other materials. We're looking at the sort of circular economy as well. So we're trying to attack this from a technology standpoint, and you know, trying to put technology and enablers around, as I said, the manufacturing, the distribution, and then the use of electricity, but as a consumer, and making sure that, you know, we're playing a leading role in ensuring we're carbon neutral as well.
I think that's fantastic. And I think that, you know, in terms of we as a society, because I think we all acknowledge that to reach the, you know, the UK government's target of 2050, it's such an enormous collective responsibility, both on individuals, but also in terms of the business community, the transport, you know, and infrastructure across the UK and Europe and beyond as well. Really, I think a big question here around getting to carbon zero and the direct impact that consumers in their homes can actually have. With the huge drives into efficiency that we have seen over the past, you know, 5 to 10 years in white goods, for example, becoming more and more efficient, and, you know, with smart switches and plugs and so on. Mm-hmm. Do you think that actually, over the next couple of years, we're actually kind of going to see a bit of a barrier in terms of the consumer can't necessarily do too much more in terms of our devices are sort of reach almost peak efficiency, for want of a better word?
It is a tricky one, and you're limited by the infrastructure that's, let's say, already in place within a property. A lot of the work that we're looking at the moment is, okay, we've mentioned a little bit about the manufacturer of a product, so the asset provider, let's say the integration aspect or interoperability. But there's then this third sort of element of home energy management really that comes into that, which I would say plays the big role in adding some more intelligence to these type of platforms and devices. You know, you can use that type of system in theory then to, you know, redistribute energy to where it's needed, when it's needed, and have some intelligence not only from the, let's say, the end point of a product, but also back all the way through a system to the energy provider as well. And it does require cooperation at that level. I mean, there are some companies that are currently offering, let's say, everything from the product all the way through to the home energy management. But ultimately, I think when we look at a mass market approach, then it certainly is important to create that sort of end-to-end element. And, you know, quite similar, I guess, in what Remy was saying about grid to plug. I mean, it really is about creating that full connection through to get better economies out of the products that are being sold to consumers. And I think you touched on an interesting point within that is that, you know, things like sensors and things like that can help us to gain better intelligence by gathering better data as well. So it's something that can improve over time, you know, based on a product, for example, that could well be installed now, could have greater benefits as a more complete home energy management system becomes available or apparent.
Yeah, I think from my perspective, I would say, you know, I'm a continuous improvement disciple, I guess, or advocate, you would say. We always have to believe that whatever we're using today, we can do more efficiently and we can do better. You know, I think that's got to be the mantra. And it's got to be, I would, in some instances, be small steps along the journey. You know, I think Stephen painted, you know, quite a picture that says, you know, it's a hell of a challenge that we've got to get from where we are today to, you know, a carbon zero future. And we don't have a lot of time to do that. But as with any journey, we need to start some sort of steps along the way. And, you know, we've made some big inroads in terms of smart heating systems and already saving energy. We can do more for sure. And we can come out and make sure that technology is used in a wider base of homes. As we then start to move forward, you know, as John mentioned, home energy management is another big step. We sort of feel that interoperability of all the devices in a home, and then managing the total energy usage that a home is using, and married with time of use tariffs and demand, you know, demand side response. And we've just got to keep that relentless pace towards, you know, some of the steps will be small, will be incremental, but at the same time, to reach where we want to get to, we need some big step changes as well. And that's where we've got to, I think, try and do both alongside each other and believe that we can keep eking out additional savings and additional efficiency improvements, you know, every day, every week, every month, I guess.
It's not going to happen overnight. It's going to happen very irregularly across the scene. And you're going to be in a situation where you've got some houses that are very efficient and some houses that have not improved at all. And I think you should probably be looking at local energy systems and making sure that the local energy system is improving as well. And I think that's a role for certainly Schneider to look at, because if you can control the whole energy in an area, and if you can actually talk with the DNO or whatever they're moving on to slowly to actually get your energy cheaper, because if you lump it all together, you become a large energy user, and you get different rules of buying your energy. You could save quite a lot that way. So looking at whole areas is a good way of dealing with it, and also it tells everyone in the area how efficient you are in comparison with your neighbours. That may or may not be a good idea.
Competition's always good, surely.
So I think that leads us actually quite nicely into another discussion point, really, which is there's been a lot of toing and froing in the market between whether or not we as consumers should be using less energy or using energy more efficiently versus the level of energy that is produced by the energy industry that is sustainable, be it solar, wind, tidal or other. Does it have to be one or the other? Is it a combination of both, or is it actually around effective energy management?
Yeah, I think that it, as you've mentioned, it is a combination. I think that, you know, there's the sort of traditional way of sourcing everything from the major utilities and really trying to sort of facilitate and get those to use more recyclables will continue. But we've seen huge inroads in terms of offshore wind as one example. I do feel though that there is going to be a move more towards local manufacturing or production of electricity that's going to be consumed in people's homes. So, you know, as we move to more of an electrical future, then we can't rely wholeheartedly on, you know, the grid being there to provide all our electrical needs. So there has to be a sort of a transition there. There has to be a way in which communities or, you know, neighborhoods or areas can sort of collaborate and work together in sort of sharing or using the electricity that's produced at a time when they want to use it, and where it's more convenient or cheaper than taking that from the grid. So we can see that ecosystem moving of more local production, in addition to ensuring that the grid is much more sustainable in producing the electricity that we're going to need as well.
John, as well, just to add to that, the messaging that consumers have is so has changed so much. It used to be, you know, don't leave your TVs on standby, and now we're looking at sort of completely changing the way that we deliver, and we have to completely change the way that that consumers are delivered energy and pieces like that. You know, what do you think, where do you think the real innovations are going to lie in terms of energy management in the home and beyond over the next, you know, between say now and 2030? Sorry, that's a very open question.
No, that's fine. I mean, for me, it depends on the type of property you have. I mean, Stephen alluded to the fact that every property is different and unique in its own way. Some might have some insulation, some might have solar panels from when feed-in tariffs existed. You know, there's this real mix out there of solutions. And you know, as Remy said, it is a combination of all of these different elements that we need to draw on to create some sort of solution and step change. And you know, for me, what's even more important is that we're more affected by external factors with these type of sustainable solutions, in the fact that, you know, the sun shines during the day and we need electricity more so at night at the moment. Wind blows irregularly. I mean, given that we're on an island, we're luckier than others, of course. But there's this real disparity between when electricity can be produced and when we actually need it. So, you know, there's a huge educational effort that needs to happen, and there is a huge change that needs to occur. Perhaps maybe some sort of post-COVID new normal can help with that transition if we're all made to work at home as well. So, you know, there's many things that I would say that go into it. But when I look on, let's say, in perspective of the home, I think there's still more that can be done with the infrastructure we also have. You know, something that's familiar with people today. I mean, one thing we haven't mentioned, you know, a lot of the boiler manufacturers that have a huge network of gas are currently examining things like hydrogen boilers and topics like this. So, you know, I really think that there's ultimately going to be a balance that is specific to the type of home that you might well have today to start that transition, to start that step change. And that can be confusing and that can be difficult to educate. But if we can improve the user interaction and improve the messaging and improve the way in which we engage with customers, I think it can certainly help them to make the right decisions for their type of property to use it, not necessarily less electricity all the time, but more efficiently.
Mm. Stephen, I think there's a really interesting point there. Despite the sort of the wide array of the sort of the housing stock that we have in the UK, do you think that the industry could be working together better to either define or demand or sort of consult on a sort of a minimum standard for energy usage in homes?
I think a lot of people are looking at deep retrofit, the Manufacturing Technology Centre for one, and quite a lot of other people, including Energy Sprong, are looking at deep retrofit. Mm-hmm. And the question is, how deep is your deep retrofit? Are you taking the roof off and replacing it, as is often the case? If you've got the roof off, what can you do inside the house? Do you need to strip out the wiring and replace all electrics? I think there's a very big business for everybody around the table. If we went for deep retrofit, that's my pitch. I think we need to be thinking, what can we do on the deep retrofit front? Mm-hmm. How can we persuade government actually it's a good idea? How can we actually make it happen? And it's something I'm trying to do within SH&BA into the future.
I would concur on that, Stephen. I think, you know, the retrofit element is an area that I think from the last session that, or one of the sessions that that you conducted was really quite eye-opening for me, and it sort of harps onto the point of collaboration, you know, the aspect that to do, you know, more retrofit and to make it more cost effective, you need various stakeholders with various sort of, you know, disciplines and technologies coming together.
I think that's certainly a possibility, but something has got to drive it. We actually need all the manufacturers and all the consumer associations and user groups involved in this. And you want awareness. Unless people are aware that they are using too much energy and they can save energy, and it is possible not to have such a high energy bills, and they can put in things like heat pumps to replace their gas boilers and so on. But we need to get everyone to work from the same hymn sheet. It's anything but that at the moment. And we need to get through to government. I mean, Boris is busily suggesting we build. We actually need to refurbish.
No, I completely agree. And the heat pump example is quite a nice one, because for heat pumps to work well, they need a really efficient fabric within the house. And today, that's not possible. But absolutely, if there is a mechanism to better refurbish the existing stock, then heat pump could well be a better solution that moves to sustainably produced electricity, you know, sources.
Remy, a question for you here, I suppose, in terms of the role that data has to play, both in terms of monitoring from a wider grid point of view, but also in terms of a consumer awareness point of view. Arguably, one of the biggest sort of rollouts and, I suppose, attempts at sort of mass market education was the government-sponsored rollout of smart energy meters, which, of course, were designed to get people aware of the energy they're using and hopefully then drive down energy bills and energy usage. But I think that we, as a sort of an industry, can all agree that there have been mixed results on the impact that that's had. You know, how do you think we could better be using data to understand and to drive change in the consumer's mind?
It's a great question. And I think the sort of principle behind smart meters, I don't think anybody would sort of, you know, disagree with what was trying to be achieved here by putting more sort of information in terms of consumption into the hands of the consumer. The execution of it maybe is something else, and we could probably take up a whole hour talking just around that. But we're trying to sort of disaggregate and break that sort of detail down into a more meaningful and simple to understand bite, if you want. So, you know, if we take and we can sort of show how much gas is used for cooking, then people can sort of understand, okay, that's, you know, my behavior or action on that side is costing X. And for the heating side, which is obviously where we have our domain knowledge, where, you know, we're pretty close to having it where we can accurately measure and record, you know, what people are spending in heating each individual room of their home. And that's where we sort of aspire to, where people can then start to understand, you know, if I'm heating just my sort of, you know, my bedrooms, it's costing me X, or, you know, if I'm heating my lounge, it's going to cost me Y. And I think the principle we're trying to get to is to just sort of making the data meaningful, making it sort of to a point that's simple to understand, and then hopefully is going to make people sort of question and think around, you know, how they're you know, doing certain things in the home, making them think before they take an action.
I think you'll find there's a massive inertia about people actually doing something. It's one of the real barriers to most of the stuff we're talking about. So how do we make it obvious that they need to do something without it being too painful?
It's such a tough one, isn't it? And you're right, customers won't go out of their way to find that information. And I don't know whether incorporating it into bills better or adding easier functionality. You know, smart speakers are hugely popular at the moment. Is there certain engagements that could be done through that? That engagement, I guess, is something really over time we need to think of and to hit in an emotional way. In one sense, because if it can be hit in an emotional way, let's say in the pocket or so on and so forth, it's a powerful way to encourage encourage that change.
No, you're right. I think that, you know, we're all optimists, right? You know, trying to sort of believe that, you know, the move to carbon zero is going to prick people's conscience as well. But, you know, I think the fact that we've all spent significantly more time in our homes over the last 3 months perhaps has made people a little bit more aware in terms of what they are sort of spending and what they do in the home and how they do things in the home. So maybe that's something that could spark something new that 6 months ago or in the past we would say it's a real challenge. Who knows? Maybe the last 3 months gives us something to sort of grasp at.
And I think as well, looking at the events over the past year or so, I think there's also a generational question here. The climate protests, the school strikes, saw huge demonstrations up, across the world, primarily attended by people who are school age. And within the next, 5 years or so, they're going to start to occupy their own properties. And I wonder if actually the energy market is going to have to respond to a change in consumer demand, where they are going to be demanding sustainable energy as standard, and whether or not that's going to help drive that conversation as well.
Great point as well. I was sort of chuckling as you were saying it, because one of the points and the reasons why we're trying to sort of disaggregate information down to an individual room is if my daughter or son knew that it would cost X amount for them to sort of, heat and use their particular room, would that change their behaviours? So
gave it back in pocket money.
I think it's a great point. I'm not maybe fully convinced about it, but I do think there is a thread there that says, if there is a teenager, and you're right, you incentivize them to say, well, whatever you save, you can do whatever with it. I'll add to that and you'll get it back at the end of each quarter. Then, who knows, maybe that starts to drive change as well.
It's the future version of go and wash the car.
Well, now, interestingly, speaking of cars, I think that there is the other topic of conversation is the big change I think we are experiencing, or the transformation we're experiencing at the moment, is the sort of the widespread acceptance and use of both hybrid and also electric vehicles in the UK. Now, I know that obviously nobody here is necessarily an expert in the market, but I think that what might be useful here is to sort of discuss the lessons that we think the EV market could learn from the smart home market, and what we've kind of learned over the past few years, as again we've seen adoption grow, and also some of the challenges that we've overcome. And also the role that I think infrastructure has got to play, because that's also a common thread between the smart home market and the EV market as well. What do you think the barriers that the EV market are going to have to overcome, and what lessons can they learn from the smart home market?
I think most of the barriers are actually being overcome. The battery technology is improving rapidly, so they go much further for a charge, and it's also cheaper. The real barriers, I think, are more in the infrastructure. If everybody in an area has an electric car, they're probably going to pull down 20 or 30 kilowatts overnight to recharge that car. If you do that on a local area, you're going to kill the DNO. They're going to have to reinforce all their wires. And that's a question possibly for Remy to pick up, because how do we deal with that?
I think the element around the what Stephen says, I think a lot of the barriers are down, but where we are seeing some of the questions is around how and where do we charge our cars, and Schneider has an EV charging business, so it's something that we've got a stake in, and one area that we've been focusing, I would say, our attention is maybe not at the consumer level to begin with, but more at industry or commerce, that where people are driving to the office and then parking their cars up. At the moment, you'll see that there's maybe three or four parking spaces, and then it's a fight to see if you had electric cars en masse, who would then sort of get there first, or who would be able to gazump the others in getting access to those charging points. So, Schneider's approach has been around sort of creating microgrids where a number of people are coming, and rather than taking it off the grid, you look at producing that for your own sort of, you know, estate, or you share that amongst other offices that are in the same physical location, and that way you can serve a wider group of cars, and really then try and drive incentives into your employees to move, you know, away from sort of, you know, petrol and diesel and moving more towards electrical vehicles.
Yeah, I mean, I do completely agree with what Remy says, and I would maybe just add that the aspect of the fleet system can have a huge impact, I think, on this type of adoption, in the fact that, you know, ultimately fleets are managed by fleet managers who want to make efficiencies. And if they can find that within a system, then it's going to help with adoption of these vehicles, I would say. The other, let's say, the other aspect, you know, that that Remy mentioned, obviously, in terms of charging more during the day at work. I mean, I still think it is going to have to ultimately be a balance, and you know, we also need to address the issue at how we can convert that on individual housing as well. But you know, it does have to balance between the two. For me, you know, when you look on a individual basis, I still think cost is a slight issue with adoption when we're comparing it with, say, the existing system. Grants are in place at the moment. I think they're around £3,000, but you know, they're considering taking up to say £6,000. But yeah, you know, I read a piece a couple of days ago that said even with that, it's going to take 5 years to recoup the higher price of an electric vehicle versus the existing diesel type cars. So, you know, it's a barrier, but more from, I would say, the government needing to do a little bit more to encourage it.
Again, I think that actually, you know, in comparing with the existing sort of smart home and IoT markets, again, it's that question of cost of implementation versus essentially perceived benefit amongst consumers that I think that there is a long way still to go in the market just because that price point is higher. Now, I mean, as Remy was saying, that, you know, those costs are coming down, but until people can necessarily see the day-to-day savings, I suppose, you know, there is a question of just how far adoption is going to go. But I think we have also touched on a very interesting point around sort of government incentive and policy. And we've seen it, for example, where new builds are now, there's the standard, you know, you have to have an electric vehicle charger built alongside, you know, new builds. Do we think that we could see similar sort of standardizations coming either from the market or from government or from, you know, local authorities, for example, to help drive adoption and usage?
My viewpoint would be, you know, yes, we do. I think that, you know, if you look at how people use the vehicles and cars today, a lot of them are on short journeys, you know, traveling to and from work, or, you know, going and doing the shopping, et cetera. And seeing, you know, that infrastructure continue to grow. And, you know, I read today that McDonald's have announced that they're going to be putting charging stations into any of the new premises that they're building. So, you know, more and more that's another element that you would, you know, see the charging stations in more places, you know, consciously and subconsciously, you start to say, well, you know, actually, you know, why wouldn't I have an electric car now? Because you're seeing the ability to sort of charge, as well as the technology and the distance you can drive in electric cars getting bigger. You know, I do believe that, you know, the next sort of, I would say 2 to 3 years, there's going to be quite a transition and transformation as the cost points come down, as the availability becomes wider, there's much more choice of cars from many more manufacturers, and that you're seeing these charging points in a lot of places that you're driving by as well.
Mm. But you can still do most of your daily traveling very comfortably. Mm-hmm. It's only when you want to go, say, from where I live to Bristol or from Dover up to the Midlands or something of that nature, that you suddenly find that actually you haven't got enough battery to get you there. For anyone local, people who live at home or just do short trips, and people working from home most of the time or with a workplace near to where they live, it isn't an issue. And I think the other thing concerning petrols and diesels is that I think they're going to come down in price in comparison to electric vehicles quite a bit, because the industry is going to find itself with an awful lot of manufacturing capability of petrol and diesel, which they want to somehow utilize to the very end. Whereas electric vehicles are basically new and are not necessarily as difficult to build. I mean, the number of parts in an electric vehicle is a fraction of those in a petrol or a diesel.
John, you touched actually on a very interesting question around fleet management, and whether or not the future is actually goes beyond private vehicle ownership, especially as, you know, with potentially the use of drone technology, being able to deliver a lot of things to us in our homes. And I think if COVID-19 has taught us anything, it's actually that a lot of commuting is for a large portion of the population actually unnecessary. So as people have a sort of less and less need to travel, even some of the sort of the day-to-day short distances, you know, in the very long term, we may be going to see sort of the end of private vehicle ownership, or at least a much smaller scale than we see today.
Crystal ball wise, I mean, I do think fleet will certainly play the biggest role in the adoption over the next few years, more so than necessarily individual, because I think the benefits to industry could be positioned in a way that would be much better. I don't necessarily think that private ownership will go down, but it depends really on what type of benefits ultimately fleet can deliver. Because if more people are able to gain benefits from charging at work, etc., as well, and companies are able to get more efficiencies by the fact that they're offering these vehicles as well, it could well go in that way. For me, it may be a bit early to tell at the moment, but I certainly do think it will be the first in the process, let's say, or the most important first step we could take is energizing the fleet vehicle market.
For any organization that wants to be carbon zero, you know, as a manufacturer or as a consumer themselves, then you have no choice in a lot of instances other than moving your company cars at some point over to electric. And we know that company cars drive a large portion of new car sales. So, I think there's a natural tendency there that says fleets are going to have to move over to a more electric element. It's also more tax efficient to actually own an electric car than it is a diesel, where you'll continue to be punished going forward year on year. But as Stephen mentioned, I think, you know, our sales guys push back in terms of range and are we able to go and see customers there and back in the same day, etc. My belief is the range of the cars in the coming 2 to 3 years is going to increase, and the ability to sort of charge during those journeys is going to be quicker and faster and easier than it is today. So we'll be able to overcome those. And once fleets start moving over, then I think, you know, what you have is, you know, I may well have an electric car and then sort of engaging and seeing what it's like to actually live with an electric car, what that experience is like. You then become an advocate for it if that experience is good. So the next purchasing decision, provided that it isn't too cost prohibitive, then, you know, you'd start to sort of feed and influence, you know, your experience into your own other purchases that you have a choice on, and maybe of friends and other family members.
It's also interesting to think that we might be blessed. I mean, I agree that I think the range issue will not be a problem in a few years as well. And yeah, the fact that actually the UK is a relatively small island, quite densely populated, will actually for once be in our benefit. And, you know, it can help, it can certainly help the UK to better adopt electric car usage as well.
Brilliant. Well, gents, thank you so much for coming and chatting with us today. I think that there's certainly a lot of food for thought. And I think that, as you say, the industry is certainly, all industries are certainly in for a challenge over the next 20 to 30 years as we sort of work towards that government target. So really appreciate your time. And yeah, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Well, I'm afraid that's all for this episode, but thank you very much to you for listening, and thank you to my guests for joining. If you want to know more, head to beaconagency.co.uk/podcast, and we very much hope that you'll join us on the next episode. Thanks for listening.